Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is Leonard Johnson. Welcome all of you to the sixth edition of the Triple Wing Hammer Report. And thank you all for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us tonight. And we hope to make it entertaining for you. Not only that, we hope to let you come away with something that you can use in your program for your success. And just a reminder why we call it the Triple Wing Hammer Report. It is my personal belief that any offense with a wing in it is a potent, dangerous, and lethal offense. It just gives the defense so many headaches and everything. And you know, if you're not running anything with a wing, God be with you. We invite all coaches who run any form of wing offense to join us. We are not limited to double, single, or wing T. We just we want to share our ideas because I think they're all cousins to each other. And we also want those coaches who are currently building great programs, you know, using wing offers to join us too, because we learn from each other. And, you know, if you're not learning in this business, you are definitely going back the other way. Before we get started, though, I want to send our prayers and best wishes to Steve Colanti and his family. You know, in a post earlier this week, I had that Steve's daughter had been sick and hospitalized since last Tuesday. And, you know, he was scheduled to appear on the show. But, you know, family come first in this business, you know, in the coaching business. So if you're listening, Steve, we are praying for your daughter's speedy recovery. And look to talking to you here pretty soon. Now for some announcements, for our normal announcements this week. The number one is the National Single Wing Coaches Association Symposium is coming up in June. And that's going to be held in Dumfries, Virginia. And that time is coming up rapidly, people. It's going to be June 26th through the 28th. And you go to their website, you'll get all the information that you have right there. And sometime in the in the near future, we're going to have the organizer of that event here to talk about it. I think I'm going to get him on next week just to give us some brief information about it. But the speakers are going to be Travis Connors, and his topic is going to be using multiple formation to attack defenses and quick kick as a weapon. Derek Miner is going to be talking about the Princeton High School single wing system. Mickey Thompson, he's going to be talking about the Stonebridge High School system and adjustments that he's made over the years. Sean Orr is going to be talking about the T-Series. And Corey Parker, who was once a guest on this thing about 3 weeks ago, he's going to be talking about the Dutch Ovens, which is the Dutch Myers short punt and the River Rouge system. And they're also going to have a Legends panel there. And, guys, you know, it's good we can sit down with people who have touched the hands of the greats in this game. Ed Reisley, I'm sure, has been around for a long time, and he has befriended and touched the hands of a lot of coaches that we read about today. And he's going to be on that panel. And Josh Rykovic from Colorado, who's right down the street from our guest tonight. These guys put together probably have forgotten more football than a lot of us will ever know. And, of course, you know, the cost of it is cost-effective. The cost is $25 per coach. And if you bring your entire staff, it's a grand total of $50. So you can't beat that deal, even if you have to get two rooms and sleep together. You know, I used to do that when I was coming up, we all get in one room, and we just come up there to learn football. It wasn't much sleeping, but you know, we just needed some place to lay our head at night. So if you can, you need to get there because, again, as we've been talking about this all the time, unless you are educating yourselves, you're not helping your kids. And this is what we're in business for, to help our kids and to help us grow. The Single Wing Conclave, which will be held March 6th and 7th of next year, will be in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And the great Todd Bross is organizer for that great event, and as soon as he starts getting his stuff together, which will be late in the fall and everything, speakers and everything, we'll be announcing that. We don't have any new books this week, but you know, for those who are here for the first time, you know I'm a big on reading, and not necessarily about X's and O's. You know, we can find books about X and O's. X and O's just part of this business. As a couple of the guys, two or three of the guys have talked about, matter of fact, all of the guys have talked about, this thing is about relationships with your kids, with your staff and everything. And just for those people who are new to our show tonight, we are going to give those books out, the name of those books. And I recommend you get these books and read them. They're great books as far as learning the other part of the game, you know. And, you know, you see how other people do it, and you can take these things and wrap it around in your program to build those relationships with your kids, staff, and basically with your community. The first one is Win Forever, Win Work, and Play Like a Champion by Pete Carroll. You know, Pete has had some ups and downs in his career, and he just learned and learned from those episodes, and look where he landed. The Butterfly Effect by Andy Andrews, a great book, a short 20-minute read, but it's profound in the message that it gives. Season of Life by Jeffrey Marks, Inside Out Coaching by Joe Erman, and Good to Great, one of my best, probably one of the best books I've ever read, Good to Great by Jim Collins. So if you would, if you're looking for some summer reading or looking for a week reading, all depending on how fast you read, pick up one of these books to, just get away from the X's and O's for a while, and so that you can learn about relationships and about how to take new approaches into building your program. Of course, if you got any suggestion of coaches that are doing great jobs in their programs with Wings, let me know so we can bring them on the show. There's always good to see a lot of ways how we can do it. Everybody's not the same. You have to put your stamp on what you do, and if it's working and everything, we'd like to know about it. Learn from you and all that stuff, because again, as I said, if we're not learning, we are dying. Any kid you may have that has done something special, let us know so that we can give them a shout out here on the show. We are in this thing for the kids. The kids come first, and we want to give all the shout outs to these kids that we can. And just so happened we have three today that need mentioned tonight. Reading from another forum site, I found that we had three young men who are going to get an opportunity to further their careers in the National Football League. They all came from some sort of winning program. The first one is Jacob Peterson from Menominee High School in Michigan, who signed a free agent contract with the Atlanta Falcons. Danny Sorensen from Brigham Young University via Colton High School in California. Alfonso signed a free agent contract to the Kansas City Chiefs. Then we got Nate, and I know I'm going to mess his last name up, but Harold will let me know. Nat Burhey, a fifth-round draft choice from San Diego State via Colton High School, and he will be going to the New York Giants, where he'll join another Colton alumni, Alan Bradford. So there goes three more holes in that belief that what we do does not prepare kids for the next level. And as long as we can keep putting those positive things out there, let's keep doing it, because we got to tell our story. We cannot let people define who we are. We know we're doing a good job, but sometimes we got to beat our own chest so people can get it, because we can't let people continue to say that we don't do what's right, and we know what we're doing is not getting our kids prepared for the next level. We got a special guest tonight. I was lucky to get him. A lot of guys had never heard of him. But before we do that, I want to play a special tribute to him to bring him in. And as soon as you listen to this, we'll go ahead and bring our guests on, and then we'll get rolling. So everybody listen to this, and I hope he likes it.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door. When he first came to the mountains, his life was far away. On the road, hanging by a thong. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast, and it don't last for long. It's the Colorado Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. The shadow from the starlight is softer than a lullaby. Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
He climbed to see the mountains. He saw silver clouds below. He saw everything as far as you can see. And they say that he got crazy once, and he tried to touch the sun. And he lost a friend but kept a memory. Now he walks in quiet solitude, the forests and the streams, seeking grace in every step he takes. His side has turned inside himself to try and understand the serenity of a clear blue mountain lake. Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Now his life is full of wonder, but his heart still knows the fear of a simple thing he cannot comprehend. While they try to tear the mountains down to bring in a couple more, more people, more scars upon the land. In the Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. No, he'd be poor a man if he never saw an eagle fly. Rocky Mountain High.
And let me bring on the great Phil Bravo from Louisville, Colorado. Are you there, Phil?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Leonard?
I'm doing fine. I tell you what, one of my favorite states to visit and one of my favorite songs. Can't get better than that.
That was great. I like that. That's a good intro.
How's everything going with you out there, man?
Really, really good. Really good. Our springs clicked in. We had, 7 inches of snow last weekend, and then it was 85 today. So it's our dry climate is turning into the Emerald City. Everything's getting nice and green, so spring is in full effect, and it's just absolutely beautiful. We're loving it.
Oh, that's great, man. Let me, for everybody living east of the Mississippi and have never heard of Phil Bravo, could you tell coaches who you are? And introduce yourself to everybody.
Well, I started out in as a head coach in 1986 for a guy by the name of Tom Caffrey at Whittier Christian High School in Southern California. And Tom, God bless his soul. I took his program over, and I was an assistant for him, and then he retired, and I took it over in 86. And through Tom, I was able to make a great connection with Don Markham back in 1984, and as an assistant coach, I was able to go to my practices, do my stuff, and then head on over to Don's practices and sit with him and go to his games as often as I could when he was at Bishop Aumont in California. Coached Eric Bieniemy, Eric Bieniemy's senior year. And I learned, a lot about offense from Don, and in my early years trying to formulate what kind of coach I wanted to be, Don was part of the ingredients of several coaches in the Southern California area that I would interview and go follow religiously. So getting my head job in 1986, we didn't have a whole lot of of great, great talent that year, but we had some really hard-nosed kids, and I started running the stack eye and was in constant communication with Del Markham, weekly, daily, sometimes more than I'm sure he liked, and this continued on for quite a bit. And in 1987, Don started around the double wing and said, I've got something that's pretty hot, and he forwarded it on to me, and we started running it together at that point. And in 1991, I moved to Colorado, and it was right around then, I believe, that Don, you know, broke the national high school scoring record with at Bloomington with that great team he had, and it's been great ever since. You know, I had a chance to introduce that offense to the state of Colorado and virtually to our region, I tell you what, I've been blessed, and we've been able to field really competitive teams, and, you know, we've had a lot of success at the schools I've been at running it.
Did the double wing fit your persona back in the early days, or just something you just dropped into?
It really did, Leonard, because back as a kid when I was growing up, you know, University of Southern California was a big football program with John McKay and John Robinson, and you know, they were off tackle right, off tackle left for many, many years, and even at an early age as a young man, 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, I had this affinity with Vince Lombardi and watching his teams and with the Green Bay Packers, and I always thought that was a great system that he used to run, getting those guards out in front. And so when Don, you know, and Coach Caffrey, Tom Caffrey, you know, started me off and got me inspired into that offense, it was a very easy transition, because even back then, it was pretty popular. I mean, not many teams do what they do today. And so if you were an off-tackle team, you were in the norm. I mean, you really were. You were in the norm. So it fell right into my personality as well and into my persona. But the other fortunate thing for me is back then I had a chance to interview some great high school coaches while I was a young assistant. And I had a list of questions, and I had a little notepad, and I'd call them up and ask them if I could interview them. And I told them I wanted to be a head coach, and I wanted to go, you know, get my personality in order and get my system. And Don was, of course, one of them. The other one was a guy named Dwayne Despain, who used to coach at Los Altos High School in Southern California. And another guy was Coach Newell, coached at Bell Gardens in Southern California as well. So between the three of them, you know, there was a lot of commonality. And but what I liked from Don was just the you know, with the stack guy, that was one thing, but the double wing just creates so much diversity in how you attack defenses. And prior to Don running the double wing, he was an I-wing guy. He ran, you know, I-formation with a wing. And back then, the old 52 monster was the most popular defense, and teams would just run their monster and match up on his wing. So he said, you know, I'm tired of doing that. I'm just going to run two wings. And I'm a speed motion and one in the back, so we're on the same stuff. Well, here we are.
I tell you what, Don, I just say it every week. Don has put many, many lives in my, you know, he's made my life longer in this business, because I'm having more fun than I ever had before in my life coaching this game. And I'm sure you are too. I've seen you speak a couple of times, two or three times, and the X's and O's, you know, you are fantastic in that. But there's some other things that you talk about in your PowerPoint and when you're in your presentation, and one of them is about how you develop your players, your player development part of it. Could you talk to our listeners about that, about how you develop your players and everything, what you expect out of your players?
You bet. We always feel, you know, and I felt this way every place I've gone, that you have to have a teaching sequence. You have to have some sort of teaching strategy to implement your game plan and your installments into your boys on the field. So we break that down into three phases. And the first phase that we teach each kid is why. And we call it the why phase, and we'll talk about it in practice. And we'll tell kids today we're going to spend a lot of time on the why phase. And we want them to know why things are important. And then the second phase is the how phase. And we break our individual teachings down, and we try to teach kids, you know, how to get to the do phase, which is the third phase. Now, while we are in the how phase, we call this regressive order. We don't start from a stance and work out. For example, if I'm having a guard go block a linebacker, a lot of coaches will put a guard in a stance, have them run out in the ball, and go block the linebacker. We reverse it. So we start them in the fit, where his hips should be, where his helmet should be, what his pad level should look like, and then we'll blow the whistle and have him take two steps. Then we bring him back into like what would be phase two, that middle phase, and we have him from that point come out, accelerate, hit, and see if we can't maintain that fit. And if we can't, then we go back to the third phase, put him in the fit, and have him take two steps. When we've mastered that, then we bring him back down to the line of scrimmage, and then we have him go through the all three phases, coming off the ball, that mid phase, just prior to that contact, and then into that contact fit phase. So that's all part of the how phase. And then the last phase, of course, is the do phase, where you want kids to get out there and perform exactly what you taught them to do. And I have found, you know, dealing with a lot of coaches throughout my years, that a lot of coaches bypass that, just get right to the do stage. And when you get to that stage, it's apparent to me that kids get frustrated, as coaches do as well, and that's where a lot of disconnect occurs. Screaming, yelling, and kids getting frustrated. And I always, you know, when we have our staff meetings and we talk about things that we need to implement, I always emphasize to my staff, have a system to teach in the three phases. Don't come out without being prepared to get this onto your mind so that it's sequential and that you can teach it to our kids so that they can understand it. So That to me is, and I picked that up early, it's been really good for us.
And you don't have a lot of rules on your team, do you?
You know, we really don't. The structure of our program, Leonard, is such that kids fall in line, fall in order, just because of the level of accountability that we hold them to in practice. And, in the old days when I first started out, there was a lot of Catholic school influence in my area, so I had kids shine their shoes by Monday. They'd have to come to practice with shine shoes. And, you know, we used to do the short haircuts and uniforms washed and cleaned and, you know, on Mondays. And those are all good things. Those are really, really all good things, and I'm not down on those by any means. But for me, I've changed my focus probably over the last 15 years, and I've made what really, really counts practice. And I've made it count to the point that that I hold kids so responsible in practice that it manifests itself in everything else that they do. And prior to doing that, I did it the opposite. You know, I would hold kids responsible for everything they did, how they dressed, what they looked like, how they came on the practice field, and not really focused in on the things that really mattered. And having reciprocated that whole thought process, it's been really successful for our program.
Do you get much pushback from your kids in that? I mean, you get these what I call outliers, you know, guys who have been used to doing it their own way. Do you get much of that who don't conform?
No, you know, we don't. And unfortunately, but fortunately, it's a good and bad thing. We'll start off with 50 freshmen, and by the time they're seniors, you know, we'll have anywhere from 16 to 30. And, you know, through attrition, you know, kids check themselves out. And, you know, I'll grab them in the hallways and just tell them, hey, you know, I still love you and would love to have you be a part of our program. And, and they'll just look and say, Coach, you know, it's just a lot of work during the season and in the off season, and I have, you know, better things to do. And I just tell them, hey, if you change your mind, just let me know. But the truth is there's a lot that we do on the field Monday through Thursday to get kids prepared for Friday. And for some kids, it's just difficult for them to handle.
Now, you also talk about and I'm going through the notes that I took at that symposium. I think it was in New Orleans. You talk mm-hmm. about you had your with the daily goals. I think that's so important. Could you expound on that a little bit?
We meet in our staff as a staff on Saturday mornings. I don't keep my staff in a lot on weekends because we all have families and kids and wives and, you know, other things that we like to do on our weekends. But we'll come into our staff meeting and we'll break down the film of our game, and then we'll break down our opponent's films. And I will have had some of my younger coaches tag the films throughout the night so that when we come in on Saturday morning, they're all tagged and ready to go through huddle. And we talk about our week and what it should look like. And for us to win on Friday night, we have to set some goals. And we put the goals on, we send them out on huddle to the boys. We put them up in the locker room, and we talk about them before we break for practice on Monday. And we talk about our goals. We dissect our goals into our individual groups and our individual positions, and then we blanket them as a whole into our entire practice. And for us, it's made the difference in our practices when you come out with a list of goals in order to be successful on Friday night. And we've talked about it as a team, when we don't achieve those goals, we struggle on game night. But I can tell you that when we come through and we accomplish the goals in our individual groups, in our individual periods, and then as a team throughout the week, we have a good shot of winning that game.
And obviously you have had a lot of good weeks according to your record and everything. That is fantastic. One of the other things you talked about, Phil, was leadership. I mean, you're talking about the program leadership and everything. And I think you were talking about the head coach. Would you want to tell us how you look at a program, how you look at yourself as a leader? What are you responsible for? What do you do to get to since you're the face of that program? What do you do to get everybody on the same page with you?
Well, you know, Leonard, I have each new coach that comes in read some of our program philosophy, and everybody has a philosophy. I mean, they're all over. I mean, I've read some really, really, really good program philosophies. And mine, I would imagine, in compared to some, is probably more controlling than not because of the dynamics of the double wing and the uniqueness behind it and what type of a coach you need to be a participant and a teacher of the double wing. So first and foremost, any new coach that comes in, I make sure that they understand the role of the subordinate. And as soon as I explain to them the role of the subordinate, I flip the coin and I give them the role of the head coach. And what my role is to lead my staff so that my staff can lead my team. My role is to be an example in the community, be an example in the school. My role is always to place, you know, academics first and never compromise a kid's grades for a football game. And I have a list of those that I read to my new staff members, and the ripple effect is just incredible because everybody comes on board with a clear understanding what my role is and what their role is. And then I'll tell you what I've done. I did this in, I'm going to go with 2010, demographics. Change daily, I believe. But one of the biggest changes in the demographic is leadership in our youth today and how kids lead. And in the old days, you know, when I first started coaching, you know, a lot of kids led by fear because, you know, a kid was bigger than you and stronger than you and, you know, bench 350 pounds. If he didn't do what he said, he might kick your butt, you know. But nowadays, you know, cultures have changed, and parenting has changed, and environments in school has changed. Columbine has changed everything across America as far as, you know, systematic pecking orders and that you traditionally have seen around high schools for years. And, you know, as a result, I think there's a lot of lacking in the leadership area of kids. So from that point forward in 2011, I have kids go through an application program to be a captain. And it's a pretty elongated adventure for them, but they have to meet with our athletic director, and they have to answer questions. They have to get approval by two or three of their peers from the same class to be involved in the final process, which is an interview by me and my staff. And then when they do become leaders, from that point forward, they meet with me once a week, and it's not about football. It's not about anything else other than how to lead and life lessons. And it has just been a beautiful organization, and it's really, really helped in building the team chemistry of our teams.
I think you listed about 10 things that you expected from your coaches. Can you remember any of them, or could you go off them on a cup? What you expect from your assistant coaches?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I expect them to be prepared for practice, and I have let good coaches go, who have a good knowledge base of the game, but don't come prepared for practice. That's one. I mean, more than anything, that's very important that kids come, my coaches come ready. Second is that you understand that building relationships with kids is far more important than anything. I've hired coaches in the past that might not have a great football base, but they have a good relational base. And I could teach them football, but I can't teach them how to build relationships with kids. And I have gotten a long way with some young middle-aged coaches who are just magnets to kids and have pulled them along with the football knowledge aspect of coaching. And then third, you know, we're not going to deviate from our offense. And if I catch a, you know, and I have, I've caught low-level coaches on a late game, you know, coming back and I'm saying, hey, what is this looking here? What, this is a 3-by-1 set. Now, where in the world did this come from? And I'll sit them down. I'll say, you know, to me, this is a sign of unloyalty. And had you come to me and said, Coach, I think I got four guys who can run and a quarterback that can really zing it, you know, maybe we would have talked about it, but that wasn't the case. You did this real sneakily. So turn your keys in, and it's been nice knowing you. And that is one of the things that's really, really important to me is that, you know, that my staff is loyal and commitment to the philosophy of our program. So that's just three out of many.
Mm-hmm. And let me make mention this if you don't mind. You can get all this stuff in Phil. You still have this for sale, Phil. How do you do this?
Yeah,
and you can give your email address out tonight, guys. You need to get this because it's one of the things that you can use to develop your program, and you don't need to take it all, but boy, it sure gives you a good solid base as to how to do things, and you need to learn from the guys who are already doing it and being successful. That's my ad for you tonight, Phil. Okay.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
Okay. One of the things you talked about, also at that clinic, was the genealogy of plays and formation. I think you alluded to it earlier. You wanted to tell the guys how this thing happened for you and everything, really get into it, the plays and the formation.
Sure. You know, for me, you know, starting off back in 1986 running the stack eye, I had a great tailback, Chris Martin. His brother Eric played at University of Cincinnati and played against the Fab Fives against Michigan in the Final Four. And he was a very talented tailback. This kid Chris was Eric's brother. And, you know, we didn't have a whole lot on that team. We had lost some good classes prior. And we ran that stack eye, and we jumped through a pretty tough conference and non-conference and ended up 7-5 and made the playoffs, got to the quarterfinal. And I learned early on that if you can establish the pitch play, it opens the doors for everything else. and or if you're if you establish the pitch play, and the pitch is still working, and others are shut down, they keep running it. And for those of you, you know, some of the listeners and so forth, you know, our championship game that we played at Mile High Stadium in 2012, we ran the pitch in the first half, and we averaged right around 7.5 yards a carry. And then we came back in the second half, and we averaged 6.3. We ran a ton of it. And, you know, for the novice, you know, football fan looking out there, I'm sure they thought it was pretty boring. But for someone who's into productivity, they probably thought it was pretty dang cool that, you know, the team we were playing is having trouble running, you know, the same play that, over and over again. So for me, you know, it's that pitch play. I mean, it's where it starts everything off. And you know, I've evolved, you know, over the years in by necessity. One year, Leonard, we did not have a fullback on campus. And, you know, our school's not enormous, but it's not small. It's 1,600 kids. And we did not have a fullback. And as a result, running a pitch play was really tough. And so we became a sweep team where we tried to hold the linebackers in with a good tuck dive, fake to the fullback. And then we kick out with our guards and our play side guard and our backside guard pull around and everything broke open, and we had a lot of success running that. Some funny things have happened over my career. I mean, things that are just, I just call them blessings in disguise. Back in 1987, we had the sweep in. We had the sweep in where quarterback would fake trap, hand off to the wing back, and then he'd bootleg out. Guard would pull. We'd reach, and kick, and then the backside guard would pull up. And then, of course, we had the pitch play in where the quarterback would reverse out, pitch the ball to wing, and then the quarterback would lead through. There's no secret there. Well, it's just like Reese's peanut butter cup. We got a little peanut butter in with some chocolate one day where the line, the blocking for the line in this practice session, we blocked it like a sweep, guard, pull, hook, reach, backside cut down, but the backfield motion was for the pitch. So the quarterback turned and pitched, and much to his surprise, and he just let out along with the fullback. So we had an armada of people leading out. And this happened back in 1987, and I gave it to Don. And Don, I said, Don, I'm calling this the power. and there you go, you know. And that was the root of that play, you know, for what I have done, and I gave it to a lot of people back then as well. And then the other funny, and I remember this from the clinic, the other funny insight, I mean, the blessing, so to speak, was the wedge. And, you know, I know the wedge is, it's fun to Google it on the Internet because you sometimes it'll show the body surfing place in Newport Beach, and one of the second Googles is actually the play that I termed the wedge because, in practice, we had a scout team All-American, Enrique Duque, who I saw not long ago, and I told him he's popular around the country where I speak because I talk about him because he was a scout team All-America. He could read our guards when our guards were sitting on their heels until they were pulling. He'd stand up as a two technique on defense and start yelling. And I got so mad at him one practice, and I told our guard, hey, get on your heels just like you're pulling. But I said, here's what we're going to do. I want everybody on Enrique. I want this wing to motion, and I want everybody else, anybody else on this field standing up, I want you guys to just fire out at him. I want this kid buried. And the quarterback said, well, what do I do? I said, just hand it to the fullback and turn on and watch. And sure enough, he did. And there goes Enrique flying backwards, dust and cleats and helmets going off. And that fullback rode the wave and rode that pile and then hit a seam and went. And I turned around and I said, that is cool. So my quarterback at the time, his name was Nick Sanchez. His brother, Mark Sanchez, plays for the Eagles now. And Nick comes up to me and says, Coach, what do we call it? So we're going to call that the wedge. I said, guys, you understand that blocking? Hip to hip, shoulder to shoulder, everybody wedge on one guy, let everyone else go. And I've been running it ever since. And so has a lot of people in America. And it's pretty cool to think, you know, that I had a little bit on that, calling that thing the wedge. And I gave that to my buddy Mark Pentgill, who is at Foothill High School up in Northern California at the time. So there's been a lot of neat things, you know, to see way back when and see where they're at now. And it's been a thrill to be a big part of this offense.
Well, that's good, man. I tell you, the whole offense is exciting to me. I tell our guys this all the time. You know, it's nothing. We call a play the hammer, and it's nothing. It's a beautiful thing to see the thing get 4 yards, get up every time, and do it again. And to see guys just laying on their back, and our guy just pulverizing these guys, to, you know, into the dirt. Nothing like it.
they're really. It's so primitive in its origin. But I'll tell you what. You know, when you get 4 yards a crack, if you walk to any major college and you say, hey, I'll give you something, I guarantee you 4 yards a crack, they sit you down and give you a pen and paper, you know, and so many coaches don't do it, and it's just fun. We take pride on it, as I know a lot of double wing schools do, just take pride on their line surge, on their wedge, and we practice it weekly, and it's been a lot of fun to see how that's kind of filtered out across America since 1987.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to some dirty football talk now. I believe the most important group in the wing offense is the offensive line. And you got some special ways how you develop your offensive lines. And when you talk about that, could you tell us what your blocking, could you describe your blocking rules to us and so we can get a flavor of it?
You bet. And it is unique, and it's something I take for granted because, you know, I'll get called from coaches all across America. I got a call from a coach just last week, and he's from the Northeast and wants to run the double wing, and he has run a little of it, and he sent me his film. And immediately the first thing that stands out is the line search and or the lack of. And I watch, you know, guys who run this, who've been running it for quite a while, and, you know, it's not as big of a necessity for their line to surge off, you know, at a certain pad level because they have big guys. And typically, next year our team will be pretty typical for us where, you know, we're around 6'1", 6'2", around 235. You know, we don't have the big, you know, monster 6'6", 350 guys. We're, you know, that would be an anomaly for us. Right now and next year's team will be right around 6'2", 235 across the board, which is more typical for us, but we're going against some big humans. So starting back when, way back when, in the in the mid-'80s, I developed a blocking philosophy that has been very, very adaptable by my teams over the past years, and it's establishing the laws of leverage. And we don't want to cut anybody because when you cut somebody, you get a pile up. We don't want to go upstairs on them because typically we're not big enough and strong enough to have any maneuverability with bigger, stronger, faster guys. So we go for the point that we feel we have an advantage for in our attacking spot is the hip. And we practice this every week, 2 to 3 times a week. And we practice with our feet, our angles on our down blocks. We practice what our aiming point is with our shoulder pads and our helmet. And, we've done really, really well in creating a line surge that sometimes is it's hard to replicate in practice if you're our opponent. And you know, so now what you get is you get defenses who have these big guys, these 6'6", you know, 295-pound guys, who are getting double-teamed at the hip. And now you create and force them to drop their pad level, and at times they become inoperable as a defender because they're used to standing up, pressing, using their hands, you know, shredding, and it doesn't work for us. So first and foremost is on our down blocks, you know, we step with our inside foot at an angle. And then our aiming point for our helmet is the inside opposite hip. And we want to make sure our backs are bowed. We want to make sure our heads are up, but that we're bent and we're hinging at the knees and not hinging at the waist. And we practiced this so much, and we put so much emphasis on it, even to the point where we even had a special sled made for us. And it's a 7-man sled and has small little blocks on it, some 2.5-foot bars that come up off the sled. And we call it the 7 Dwarfs, and we put the kids on the dwarfs. And if you're a bigger, taller kid, you're going to struggle unless you keep your feet moving at a pad level or you should fall on your face. And it is just an incredible piece of machinery that we have out there. And our, again, Leonard, I've seen a lot of double wing teams out there who are, you know, who have better talent than we have, who actually are, you know, even better coached. And one thing I can tell you that I haven't seen yet is an offensive line that that has a line surge like ours.
So you big on the surge, everybody coming off in at the right at the hips.
We are, and we're gonna stalemate the bigger guys at best. Mm-hmm. And then what we hope we do is we get good defenders now bear crawling through the holes. And if we get that, we think we can win the battle.
What rules do you use up? I know you keep it simple. What rules do you use up front for your kids?
Well, you know, first and foremost, you know, on most of our plays, you know, we're down blocking. Mm-hmm. And the rules are that if you have a guy inside shade of you as a down blocker, then he's your guy. If you have a guy head up on you, then you're going to double team with the guy outside, and you're going to keep your inside eye open for a linebacker who's scraping or peeling through. And, you know, our double teams were at the thighs. We try to go hip to hip and shoulder to shoulder, and we try to bend. We work hard on bending and bending. As a matter of fact, if we have any sort of injury or ache, typically by our linemen, it's in their lower backs. That's where we're a big deadlift team, which I know a lot of teams aren't anymore. They're more CrossFit type teams, but we're a big deadlift team because our lower backs have to be so strong because of our pad level and our get off. So our heels are off the ground, stepping with our inside foot. If I got a guy inside me, I'm going to work across his hip to his inside hip. I'm going to step with my inside foot, and then I'm going to get real wide on my base. I'm going to bow my back. I want my rear end just slightly higher than my shoulder pad, and I'm going to work hard on a good chop and drive block. If he's head up on me, I'm going to come off with my outside shoulder on his hip, with my inside eye looking for a linebacker who's scraping through a gap. The guy to my outside will treat the guy who's head up on me as a normal down block, but he'll know he'll get assistance for me at least for the initial get off. And the other thing, too, the word is deceiving when you talk about down blocks. You talk about down blocks, you typically image, you know, everybody getting blocked down. When we say down block, we always emphasize that, yeah, down block is the nature of a block, but the real true feature of the block is that we want to block them off the line of scrimmage in the linebacker flow. So that now linebackers are undercutting their scrapes and or bowing hard over the top, in which they do, we've got the game won.
Once you get those linebackers, we call it running the hump. Once we get them running the hump, we're in a good shape. There are a lot of guys who are struggling with pulling techniques and everything. A lot of them use the traditional pull. Some are going to the skip pull. Which one are you using for your backside people when they pull around?
You know, I've seen them all, and I've heard them all. And as a guard in college, you know, we were taught, you know, a lot of different techniques. But again, I'm going to tell you how we do this. And again, it's in our regressive, you know, our aggressive levels of teaching. You know, first thing we do is we set out cones, and then we put the guard just outside the wing and the tight end as though he just pulled and he's looking upfield and he's going to accelerate into a linebacker. So we'll put him there. We'll get him there nice and low, fingertips on the ground, almost leaning on his inside weight of his inside foot in his hand. We'll say hit, he swings around that corner, he engages into a linebacker. Then we put him in a phase 2, which is, you know, almost over the the offensive guard that would be in the down block on this, on the pitch play, for example. And then we have him accelerate around the corner on the hit and then engage with the linebacker. And if there's problems, we'll put him back to that third phase and just put him off the edge and just say hit and have him just run up and hit a linebacker, work on our techniques again. We're working our head to the thigh. We're working on we want to go to the opposite thigh so that that linebacker has to bow up high or undercut radically and get caught in a pile so he can't scrape. But then the last phase is that we get him out of the stance. And I have found in the past that by over-techniquing that maneuver really can constrict the athleticism of kids getting out of that block. And what I have taught in the past is that I just want you to turn and run. And with that concept, you know, of just turning and running, I feel that we have been able to harvest greater athleticism other than worrying more about their technique coming out. Really, the technique I'm more interested in is what they do when they turn the corner around the double team of the wingback and the tight end and how they engage in the linebacker. I used to spend way more time on the pull part and less time on the engagement part. Now I spend just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You still use magic?
Yes, we do.
You want to tell the story? I found it hilarious when you told that story a couple of years ago at the symposium. You need to explain what magic is. Okay, I'll let you have the floor for that. Okay.
Well, magic. I'm a big Laker fan, and I grew up in the Magic Johnson and James Worthy era, and I loved the Lakers back then. I missed the '80s, to be honest with you, we've had great success of slowing games down to a crawl. In the semifinal game to get to the state championship in 2012, we took off on a 23-play drive and four fourth-down conversions and scored with a minute six to go take the lead 14-6, and then we pooched the ball up high like a Tiger Woods pitching wedge, scooped the ball up, and then we took a knee to win it. So we had the ball the entire fourth quarter. And it's happened before where we scored with 38 seconds left in a quarter. And then I thought, you know, with Chip Kelly and his innovation of running a fast-paced offense, why can't double wing teams do that as well? And we started this out in 2012. And, you know, I put together what I consider to be a sophisticated system. And I spent, you know, a lot of time, copious hours in putting this thing together. And when we tried to implement it in spring football, it just went over dead. It didn't work. Actually, we were slower than normal. If we had broken the huddle, walked the line of scrimmage, snapped the play, it would have been faster. So we started out really, we regressed. We went backwards on this, and to the point where it was virtually comical. And what I say by that is we number our holes from the left to right, 7, 5, 3, 1, and then 2, 4, 6, 8. So we went from this again, and I had 16 starters that were 4.0 kids or greater, and we still couldn't come up and figure out what I had manufactured for them. So we went to just the most simplest form where we'd give out two numbers, and dependent upon what quarter we were in, the players would listen to certain numbers based on the quarter. If we were in the first quarter, be the first number. If we were in the second quarter, be the second number. In the third quarter, same thing. It would be the first number for the third and then the second number for the fourth. And our quarterbacks would come up and give a certain bogus term that really didn't mean anything, and then they would come out with a number, and then we'd run, if it was the first quarter and he yelled 75 Miami, 75 Miami, we'd run a 47 sweep. If he ran the first quarter, if he called 66 Houston, 66 Houston, we'd run a 36 pitch. And I won't bore the listeners with this huge docket of disguises and symbols that we had to get the stuff in. That worked. That worked. But I'm mistaken. We actually even went prior, before that, we just called out a number. We just called out 6 was a 36. We called out 5 was a 45. And until week 5, somebody said, hey, I think I know what this team's doing. I could hear their kids yelling at their coach from across the field. So we added a second digit to it, and we ran that all the way through in the championship. Mm-hmm. And I can't give out what we're doing now because we did it in 2013, and we had a lot of success with it. And it's a little more sophisticated, but at the same time, it's more diverse. And it was just great. So I'm willing to give that out to anybody who would want to know, want to spend some time going over that with me. But having the ability to slow down a game to a crawl, and at the same time having to speed it up, it's unbelievable. Because the fatigue factor for the defense now says this. Initially, I'm going to get beat down in the fourth quarter because this team's going to run this at me come heck or high water. Now, I have the ability to run it at them, but I have the ability to run it at them fast. I mean, we typically are ready to snap the ball before the referee has said it. And that's taxing on a defense. So, and this is no coincidence. We've run our fast-paced offense, as I know a lot of double wings have done. Let's see, the last 2 years, we were 10-2 this year, and then a year ago we were 12-2. So 22-4, so that's 26 games, and we had 15 of those teams with a running clock. Mm-hmm. In the last 2 years. We've had 15 teams with a running clock, and I've never done that before. And I attribute it entirely to our fast-paced offense.
So you can do both.
We can, and when I'm a D coordinator and I know that my opposition has the ability to do that, I just don't know, what bat he's going to swing at the plate now. Mm-hmm. Is he going to, take his time and step out of the box, or is he going to hurry up pitches? It frustrates my opposition as well as their offensive coordinator because, if we hold on to the ball long, they throw away their 12-play sequence that they've, put together as a way to beat us. And then if we score quick and then we kick that ball off, they think they have to score quick as well. Mm-hmm. So it plays with the mind of our opposition, both the D and the offensive coordinator.
What is your off season like, Phil?
We really work hard at Monarch to get kids to be multi-sport athletes. It's been something that I have preached about since day one. So we're hoping that in the winter that we have kids wrestling or playing basketball, and if they're not, they're lifting. And I run the weight room after school with them 4 days a week. In the spring, we hope kids are playing baseball, running track, or lacrosse, and we just have a new feature now at Monarch, which is rugby, which I'm not kidding you. Rugby to me now, I'm so jazzed about that sport, I scream. We have a guy who is our rugby guy in Superior, Chris Hansen. He is a brilliant man. He's expanding his organization. We have a 6 foot, 315-pound Polynesian playing, and we have our tailback playing rugby. And it's to watch those guys get out there and run. It's fantastic. And so we encourage them to do that. And then if not, they're lifting. And then we take time out for finals. And then we have spring football here coming up June 2nd, in which, we have a lot of guys come out and watch, double wing guys. So if any listeners are within our region and you're not an opponent, you're more than welcome to come out. And then we lift and run in the morning, and then we go run our spring football in the afternoon, and that goes for 2 weeks. And then the rest of the summer is pretty much running and lifting in the morning. We'll do 4 7-on-7s, and it's more so for our DBs and such, because typically the double wing, we see 7-2s a lot, cover twos with a good cloud look, and you get corners that are involved in the run game. So a lot of times, we'll go on air or we'll go on, two defenders sometimes three, and we make our quarterbacks make choices that way. And so it's a modified 7-on-7 to say the least.
So you encourage your kids to get away from you for a while.
I do, and mm-hmm. I think it's healthy for everybody. You know, I think, you know, we have so many good coaches in our school. My hope and prayers are that, you know, they learn something about, you know, leadership, responsibility, and accountability from one of my colleagues at Monarch High School. And you know, kids up with bases loaded, two outs, you know, bottom of the seventh, there's a lot he can learn from that I can't teach him in the weight room. And we've never had problems with our kids getting strong and fast and big, but we want competitors. I mean, we want competitors. We want guys who want to compete. And I have found by pushing our kids in the multiple sports has really helped our program a ton.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people the best seat in the house is the seat I'm sitting in right now. I never thought about it like that.
It's the truth. And, you know, we'll have kids come up to me as sophomores. They'll say, Coach, you know, I want to start next year so bad. I'd about do anything. What do you think I need to do? And I'll tell them, I think your balance is poor. I think your hip strength needs work. And I think you need to, you know, cut some of your baby fat. Well, what do you want me to do? And I'll walk them down the wrestling room. And I'll introduce them to our wrestling coach, and I'll say, this kid just signed up for wrestling. And they look at me, and next thing you know, they go through a 3-month program of wrestling, and they come out, and they say it was the best thing they ever did. And, you know, basketball the same way. We're blessed with a basketball coach who's an old-school guy. You know, he's all about taking charges and setting hard picks, and he says football's a collision sport, but basketball is a contact sport, and I just love the guy. And we get our kids out there, and then we have a heck of a baseball program where we have a Stanford grad who was a multi-sport athlete at Quartz Hills High School in Southern California, and he came up to me the other day and he says, "Hey, we're starting our Legion program this summer. When's your spring football?" I said, "These days." He goes, "Great, I'll have the kids out there." So that's the beauty behind it. I mean, everybody shares athletes, and then selfishly, I benefit because I get kids who are competitors, not just not just football players.
Okay, that's great. Without giving away any of your secrets, I think you've got a very unique philosophy when it comes to game planning and how you call your plays. And without giving away any of your secrets right now, could you give us a general way how you do that with your game planning?
You bet.
And how, yeah.
You bet. I mean, personnel first is always big for me when I'm looking to attack a defense. I just look at personnel and matchups to start with. And, you know, like I've said before, you know, there have been games where I will run away from a stellar defender the entire ball game. And, you know, I'm humble enough to know that I probably won't win that match. And I'll run away from them. And we have created mechanisms within our program that we practice weekly that no matter what play I can call, I can make sure the ball goes away from them. So that's first, is that we always look at matchups and see where we match up and how we're going to win that battle. And then the other thing I like to look at is I do a lot of self-scouting, and I put together a grid. And I have a week-by-week grid that I maintain throughout the entire season. So by week 9 and 10, if a guy's done his homework on me and he's got 9 game films, and he can I can tally in my mind, and I can see where he knows I'm going to be running and what he has to do to stop me. And then in my mind, I've created an attack grid where I know, you know, if he pulls people out of the secondary or and adds them into the box, you know, how I'm going to defeat him, how I'm going to go ahead and create opportunities for our offense to score because of the things that he's doing to stop me. And I do it every week, and it has really, really helped me out to be a little more, I mean, people say, well, you run 7 plays, what's the big deal? But I'm telling you what, when you try to run 7 plays perfect and you get a guy who's been spending his entire off season trying to stop you, you better articulate on how you want to attack and beat your defense.
And when you if we can get into it, what's your strategy be? You know, behind play call, I mean downs and everything. What's your strategy? And I don't want you to get into a whole lot of because you know.
No, that's not a problem. You know, for me, I've done this for years. Just never have heard it articulated as well as Lou Saban has done it, and I've kind of used a little bit of his terminology, but it's, you know, have inserted my own. Is that, you know, first down really isn't that big of a down for us. And, you know, I'll hear people talk, you know, at the Glazier Clinic in Denver, there was a double wing clinic on how to stop us. And I went and attended, and I thought it was interesting. It was really good. The guy did a real good job. And he beat me once out of three times. And, you know, he did a heck of a job. The guy's a heck of a defensive coordinator. But he talked a lot about how first down is the big down, and if you can hold us to two or under, then it changes the complexion of our next three plays. And it's just not true. I mean, it's true in a sense that it is a big down, but if we get 2 yards, that just means that I have three more downs to get, you know, another, you know, not 8 yards, and I'm fully satisfied and content with going on fourth down no matter where I'm at. So, you know, first down, here's how I look at it. If I get five or more on first down, then second down can be a complementary play. And a complementary play would be, you know, like a reverse, you know, a play-action pass, something that would not be in our base play playbook for that week. And then if I get, you know, three or under on second down, and then now I'm looking at third and two, third and three, then I'm back to my base plays until I reset the chains. Now on first down, if I get, you know, 2 yards or 3 yards, I'm going to sequence my base plays until I can reset the chains. And so what I always look at, I look at a second down, not so much a second down doable, but a third down doable. And that is all predicated off of first. So, you know, first down, if I get two, then I want to see if third down is doable. So I'm going to run my base plays on second down to get to third down, to make fourth down doable, reset the chains, and go from scratch again. But it's fun when you're getting, you know, fives and sixes on first down, then it makes, you know, things a little different for you on your second down calling. So I have that on a grid as well, and before the game, and I'll have my complementary plays that I want to run during that game. If in fact on second down I get five yards plus on first down.
Okay, well that's good. I think guys need to understand that this offense is not a three down offense. It's really a four down offense, and once you start thinking like that, it just changes your whole approach to the ball game. You know, if you can't get 2.5 yards of play on this offense, then something is wrong. You're doing something wrong, I think.
It is. I mean, because 2.5 times 4 is 10.
Every time.
I mean, and that's our concept. And I mean, you know, when we go for it on fourth down in big games, you'll hear the bands cranking up and everybody screaming. But for us, we do it all the time, so it's not that big of a deal for us. And, you know, I'll look at my D coordinator sometimes on fourth down, and I'll ask him, you know, what do you think? He says, go for it, man. He says, yeah, we'll be fine. And we've done it in big games. I mean, in the state championship, you know, we had the ball on third and two, and with less than a minute to go in 2012, and I called a quarterback sneak to see if we could stretch that ball out, and you know, and lessen the exchanges. You know, we got just quarterback to tailback, and we didn't get the first, so we're now on fourth down. So I called a no play, and, you know, I mean, we gave that team great position, and we were left by three. It was 17-14, and that ball was on the 32-yard line, their 32-yard line. So had we not made it, I mean, we could have caught ourselves into a bad, bad situation. But, you know, we jumped out there and in the old stack eye on fourth down and got 9 yards on it, and we won the game. Mm-hmm.
And it's so important that all the coaches understand exactly what the philosophy is, just like you mentioned in the beginning, whereas there's not even a hesitation from them to say, let's go, man. We know what we do. You know, we got your back and everything.
That's right. And sometimes when we don't go for it on fourth down, you watch your O-line come off the field and you just see a shadow of a doubt in their mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's times where I've seen that where I haven't called it on fourth down. And I thought, well, you know, to have tried and failed might have been better than to have punted the ball. just to maintain, you know, that level of faith that these boys have in the system and have on a fourth down call.
Yeah, you just can't talk about it. You got to do it. They got to see you do it.
That's true. I mean, you know, on fourth down, I laugh because I always watch, you know, college football and high school games. And you see on fourth down, there's this big timeout where this huge congregation of folks all come to input, you know, for what your fourth down call. If going into a game, if you don't have your fourth down call, if you don't have something to hang your hat on, you're not going to win.
That's right.
I mean, you better have a fourth down call in your playbook that you just know I'm going to do it, and the other team knows you're going to do it. But you
stop
better
me.
Do it, and you better do it and tell, yeah, and they got to stop you still.
Stop you up. Stop me if you can, because we're coming at you. You know, we got.
That's right.
It's an attitude. Let's see who has the big attitude.
Yeah,
we get
right.
So many. You know, we get a lot of complaints. You know, all the time about our brand of football does not prepare our kids for the next level. And I know you don't have that problem. Nobody screams at you and all that stuff. How many kids have you had come out of your system and going on to the next level? And just going on to the next level.
Colorado is blessed with some great Division II football programs in the Rocky Mountain Athletic Conference that run all along the western and eastern slope of the Rocky Mountains. And I'm talking some really, really good football coaches and good programs. And then we have really three big Division I programs, Colorado State University with Coach McElwain, and then right here in Boulder County, Colorado Buffaloes with Coach McIntyre, and then down to the south, the Air Force Academy, which would be a little more, you know, academically and career directed. And then we have the University of Northern Colorado, which is one double A school just a little bit north of here. And, you know, we tell kids this, is that the NCAA has created a variety of institutions that fit the academic and athletic profile of almost every student athlete in America. And there is a place for you to play and study. You just have to be willing perhaps to travel to get there and to come out with the understanding that you might not be playing at Ohio State on Saturday afternoons. Mm-hmm. And when you convey that to your kids and you open up these opportunities for them, we have had no problems getting kids into the second level. As a matter of fact, our quarterback is going to Colorado as an athlete. He signed in February. Our tailback is going to Rice University. Our offensive tackle is going to play at University of Northern Colorado for Collins. We have a one technique on defense that's going to go play football over at Western State up in Gunnison here in the mountains. And we have a fullback hybrid defensive end that's going to go play at Pima Junior College in Arizona. And I have a defensive end, you know, kind of a pass rush guy who's going to go play at Minnesota Moorhead State next year. We've had no problems. I have a strong safety that went to Princeton that was 6'2", 235, and now he's a 7 technique on defense.
So you got him coming out of your thing, running the double wing.
Absolutely, I'll tell you, Leonard. And I'm sure guys who run this system can attest to this. Is that, you know, our offensive linemen may not be able, you know, to give a big kick step and backpedal and get those palms coming out and, you know, sitting with their breastplate up high and their chin up in the air. They might not do that, but I'll tell you, what they can do is we can get these big guys to bend and to get their pad level down and to drive their feet off the ball and pull and get around the corner. And every college recruiter that comes by to see my guys will say, you know, your offense really gives your O-line the opportunity to demonstrate their real athleticism.
We have and a call.
They'll tell me for us to teach pass blocking is way easier than for us to teach what you put in these kids the last 4 years.
We have a question. We have a caller who may have a question for you. Phil, let me get him online, okay?
You bet.
Hello, this is Leonard. Who am I speaking with?
Hey, what's up, Leonard? What's up, Helmer? This is Coach Don High.
You know, hey, Don, how you doing?
What's up, buddy? What's up,
I'm
buddy?
All right. You got a question?
Yeah, I got a question for Mr. Phil. Hey, Phil, how you doing? I talked to you in the hallway probably a couple of years ago when I was speaking at the convention too in the hallway. I don't know if you took a couple of pictures.
I remember. I can see your face right now. I remember you like yesterday.
Yeah, buddy. Hey, I got a question for you about passing. I mean, a couple of questions actually. How often do you pass? And what's your favorite pass play that you normally run?
Well, how often do we pass? Last year, again, we had a great athletic quarterback that transferred in by way of move, and we threw the ball a lot more last year than we've had in the past. As a matter of fact, we led Colorado in passes to touchdown ratio, which is, you know, not many people will discover that stat. The stat, though, typically discovers just your quarterback rating, which encompasses so many different things, but as far as passes to touchdown, we led the state. And then the year before, in 2012, when we won the state championship, we threw the ball 36 times in 14 games. So this is my philosophy on that, is that, you know, if we can control our passing game and if we can make it effective and if we can make it count and we can move the sticks with it, then we'll do it. And to me, if I'm having – better success, if not more success, running the ball, then we'll continue to do that. And our quarterbacks have just been real good about coming through and understanding that that's, you know, really the focus of our game. And our best pass play that we have that we've run is where we fake that buck sweep. You know, we fake that ball to fullback. We tuck that ball into that wing back in motion, and that wing back in motion circles real hard and sits there and replaces the tight end, and then our quarterback will make that fake, and then he'll get his head and look backside. Now we'll just typically have a safety sitting backside, and we go two-on-one on the safety. We'll run that backside wing on a width route. We get him inside the hash, working hard towards the tops of the numbers, and then we'll get that tight end running a skinny post, and we'll have our quarterback stare that safety down. The safety's made any movement into the either direction, then we'll get it out of his hands right now. If he's sitting there, we'll stare him down until we can gain that distance between them, the two receivers, so that safety can't break off and make the play. And we just call that our scissor pass.
Right. So the play side wing is, he's running, you said a whip route, is he's running that towards the safety. I'm pretty sure you're in a cover. You pretty much get a cover three look, correct? Pretty much, you know.
You know, we've been getting cover two looks just to add that extra guy in the box. So our big looks for the last 5-6 years have been 7-2s, and those corners are playing right up there on the line, and those guys are danged if you do, danged if you don't corners, because if they don't come up and help on run fill, they're getting yelled at, and then the next thing you know, they get play action and they're five steps upfield, and the next thing they turn behind, and there's a wing running downfield all alone, you know, with one safety sit back there trying to sit between a tight end running a skinny post and a wing who's getting really wide. So our quarterback will make that play action to the wing, and then he'll swing that head back real quick and find that safety, and we'll try to get that ball out of his hands real quick.
Oh, I got you. So most of your completions are to that tight end or to that the backside tight end or to that play side wing? I mean, what normally do you?
More to the wing.
More to the wing, okay.
Yeah, because if most cover two teams, you know, sit their safeties at around 12 to 15 yards, they're kind of like, you know, the last of the last. And the tight end runs just right inside his hip to try to get that safety to turn into the interior of the field and turn and run with that tight end, which leaves that wing back wide open.
Right. Oh, I appreciate you, Phil, man. Always a blessing, man. Always good to hear from you, man. One thing I love about you is that, I mean, even though you're a legend, man, you just treat everyone, you know, pretty much the same, and you're willing to share the knowledge to all double wing guys, you know what I'm saying, which is definitely a blessing to the guys, you know, who look up to you guys, you and, you know, the helmet, you know, Lennon Johnson, man, you know, guys like me who've been running it for a while, but still look up to guys like you, and you guys still, you know, share the knowledge, man. You know, I appreciate both you guys. You know, it's an excellent show, too, man.
I got to tell you, you inspired me that when I was when I saw you in the hallway there, and you know, I told you back then I'm not a real marketeer. I'm really not. I remember you telling me, and I told you I'm not good at this. You know, I'm not real good. You know, I had a double wing guy from Kentucky email me last week, said he wants to get my stuff, and I said, okay. And he goes, well, how much do you want? And I said, well, tell me your background. He says, well, I'm a middle school guy. I'm just starting out coaching. So I just sent it to him. I'm not good at this stuff. But I tell you, you've inspired me to get a book going. And I'm glad
because you deserve it because, I mean, you know, you're going to be one of the forefathers in a little while, and I'm saying, and you just got a great spirit when I was talking to you. You know, you should be out there because you are, you know, a purist of the double wing, and you're just an overall great guy, buddy. You know what I'm saying? You know, and I'm happy
that.
Just to know you, you know.
Likewise, I appreciate that. I'm excited to get this book off and going. You inspired me to do it. I mean, just thinking about putting my thoughts, you know, of 28 years of running this stuff into words, it's been long, you know, and I've got my chapters outlined and I put my bullet points through, and now I'm just going to start the expansion of it. And I'm real excited. I mean, I'm real excited to put a lot of the things that I've experienced, you know, on print. And it was because of you. I mean, because, you know,
If I get a footnote to say Don High inspired me to make a book, man, that's good stuff.
You know, because I look at some of these double wing guys, you know, who are doing their things. You know, some of them, I really respect Murph. You know, the guy, he calls plays. He's in the front. He's taking bullets. I mean, he's called plays. He's innovative. I mean, Harold Strauss, same thing. The guy is called, you know, hundreds of offensive plays in his life. There's guys out there who are marketing this stuff who've never been on the offensive side of the ball, who've never even called a play. And I just thought, you know what, that guy in New Orleans, Don, you know, you inspired me to get this book going. I'll put you in the front of the book.
Well, Don, thanks so much for calling in, man, I sure appreciate it.
Hey, anytime, Helma. I'm definitely going to be checking out the show, man, because, you know what I'm saying, like I said, you know, we all run that double wing, you know what I'm saying, in some form or nation, you know what I'm saying, so, all right, Phil, hey, Phil, I'm going to be emailing you, buddy.
All right, sounds good, God bless.
All right,
Take care, Don. Phil, let me ask you one last question, and I'm glad to see that you're doing the book. I'm about to do the same thing. I'm about to do the same thing too. Believe
that's
it or not.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that is so great. I love it. Yeah. I love reading. As a matter of fact, you talk about books. My D coordinator, Dr. Ted, my D line coach, Dr. Ted Kowalik, who's one of the best dentists in Boulder County and actually in the state of Colorado, gave me a book by a guy named Malcolm Gladwell called David and Goliath. And the beginning of the book just depicts, you know, David's challenges towards Goliath. But then the rest of the book, you know, talks about different examples of everybody else, Goliath, that they may have encountered in life. And it was a very inspirational book to talk about, you know, as a coach, for me to read that, having known the story of David and Goliath since grade school, but yet to be to create more of an application towards my life and towards my team and towards all the things that I come through. It was really, really good book. So I just throw that out there as well.
Okay. Why do you continue to do this thing called coaching, Phil?
Tell you what, this might be more elongated than you had expected, but back in the 80s, as an assistant coach, I went up and listened to Jerry Faust speak at the Stovall Clinic at the Anaheim Convention Center, and he had just left Moeller High School in Cincinnati, Ohio, after, you know, several national championships and state championships, and got hired out of high school, direct stop as a head coach at Notre Dame. And I don't think he lasted long. I'm going to guess and say 2 years. And he was terminated from his job, and he was speaking at this clinic. And Coach Faust spoke that night on what kind of an impact a high school coach can have on kids, and how he struggled with that same effectiveness as being a college coach. Not to say college coaches can't, but for him, how he felt he had a greater opportunity to mold and create lives of young men. And he encouraged, you know, young coaches and high school coaches of all to stay in the level you're at and not be so pursuant of being at the highest level, that the money and the glamour and the dream of it isn't what you anticipate it to be. And it affected me, and it stuck with me for a while. And then years later, now we're back in 1998, I attend a symposium in Orlando, and there's a priest there, and I meet him, and he's a priest and a father, of course, at Moeller High School in Ohio. And I introduce myself, and I explain the same story that I just told you. And I said, I gave my card. I said, would you tell Coach Faust that he had an impact on me? And a couple months go by, and I get this package in the mail, and here's a book, The Golden Dream by Jerry Faust. And he signed it. He said, you know, Father talked to me that you had heard my speech, and I hope that, you know, coaching high school football has been all part of all of the dreams that you wanted, and remember faith, family, and football. And you know, to me, that was a borderline epiphany on, you know, what my life would be. And, and you know, a lot of people don't know this, that I lost my dad at my college football game, and my dad died in the second quarter. While I played offensive line at Azusa Pacific, we were playing University of San Diego in La Jolla, California. And my coaches were immediate to my aid, Dr. Terry Franson, Dr. Jim Milhon. They were just the best. And I've had a lot of people come through me in the coaching ranks that have really, really blessed my life. And I keep doing this because I want to be that person for some young man. And I still think I have it in me. And, you know, we're 108-16 in the last 10 years, and, you know, the residual effect of learning to love kids is winning, and I think it runs hand in hand, and I'm going to continue to do it, you know, for a while longer.
Well, we went over a little bit, but that's all right. I love every second of this. I want to thank you so much for being on the show tonight. I really enjoyed it. You know, you gave me some things to think about, and if nobody else got it, I got it. I really do, Phil. And, man, thank you a bunch, and I may be out there to see you sometime soon.
I'd love it. Let me shoot out my email for anybody who needs help. It's,
go ahead.
It's Bravo DBL. WNG, of course, like double wing, Bravo DBLWNG @gmail.com.
And
you come out here, Leonard, I'll take you to some of the funnest places. We'll go up to University of Colorado and give you the 50-cent tour, buddy.
I would love that. Also, before I get away, Harold Strauss told me to make sure I tell you hello, okay?
Yeah, you bet. He's one of the greatest men ever. He what a great coach, and what a fine human being.
Yeah, he made sure to tell me. He texted me today to make sure I tell you that. So you have a good night, man. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate you coming on at a short notice, and we'll be talking, okay?
All right, Leonard. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, guys. That concludes our show tonight, and to next week we have Rick Darlington from Apaca High School in Florida. And we hope that you join us. And gosh, we got so much good information tonight, I'm just enjoying this a lot. Guys, like I always say, take somebody, hug them, and tell them you love them. Thanks for being in tonight, and I'll see you next time. Good night.
Red roses too, I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, much more than I never knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.